Our guest today on the Science Studio is Richard Axel, University Professor at Columbia University, an investigator with the Howard Hughes Medical Institute, and the winner in 2004 of the Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine, along with his former postdoctoral fellow, Linda Buck. They got it for essentially figuring out how our sense of smell works, or as Axel puts it, how the brain knows what the nose is smelling. Richard, could you unpack that for me a little further?
Well, smell is clearly evolutionarily the most primitive sense. For virtually all organisms must have evolved a mechanism to experience their external world. And most organisms, the simplest of organisms, bacteria, have no brain and no eyes. And they need to sense chemicals in the environment because they provide an indication of the richness of the environment in terms of the provision of food, for example. They provide information about the quality of the environment, the harshness of the environment. They provide information about the gaseous content of the environment. That, in its simplest form, is smell. Bacteria have chemosensory receptors, odor receptors that reside on the surface of cells and in a relatively primitive way provide information about the external world, which results in changes, in intracellular changes that allow the organism to accommodate to its world. Now, as one moves up in evolution, one sees that system become increasingly more complex. But certainly in a bacterium, there may be upwards of 100 different receptors that cross the membrane and sense the outside world. Now, as we move into eukaryotes, simple eukaryotes such as yeast, also maintain on their surface an array of receptors that provide information which allows for sexual reproduction. So yeast, for example, have pheromone receptors. And those pheromone receptors, which interact with mating factors to allow for sexual reproduction, those pheromone receptors begin to take the molecular form of the odorant and pheromone receptors that we see in higher eukaryotes, mammals.
One of the insights that you were following in the 80s, as I understand it, was that we obviously build representations of the outside world and that we use our senses to do that. Smell is obviously a primary sense in constructing these representations. Does it take a lot of genetic components to create a sense of smell capable of doing that?
Well, you're talking about two different things. There are two problems. The first is the ability to sense the outside world. That's a problem in recognition. And the second problem is one of building a representation of that which you sense at the surface of a cell that is exposed to the outside world in your brain to allow you to translate the information in the world into something meaningful for the brain. We don't understand that second process. We're beginning to see what some of the rules are, but we don't understand. So we can talk extensively about the recognition problem and even more extensively about the problem of brain representations of the sensory world. And the reason is that we don't know very much about it, so we can talk about it.
One of the remarkable findings that comes out of your work is that there were perhaps 1,000 genes devoted to our sense of smell. With a human genome of 30,000 genes, that's 3 to 5% devoted to just one sense, which is an awful lot of genomic real estate. Could you comment on that?
Interestingly, through a food market or simply on the streets of New York, the richness of odors that you can appreciate is unlimited. In one sense, I view it the way I view vision. If you look up at that bookcase, you're looking at 100,000 discrete forms, and that is simply a meager image of what the brain is capable of perceiving. There is an unlimited number of forms in vision, and the number of chemicals, I believe, that you can recognize is unlimited. And so it would be very hard to conceive of a mechanism for recognition that didn't involve a very large number of genes. And in fact, the approach that Linda Buck, a fellow in the lab, took for the isolation of the genes encoding the odorant receptors had as one essential assumption in the identification scheme that there be many genes. So we tacitly assume this. This principle of there being many genes encoding odorant receptors threads through all organisms. So the worm, the simple worm, Caenorhabditis elegans, has a total of 16 olfactory sensory neurons. And those 16 neurons express over 1,000 odorant receptor genes. So a simple organism with a very primitive sensory system.
It's very evocative the way you talk about New York, the smells, the city, and so on. I was just thinking there was a novel written in 1985 called Perfume, which became a movie, I think, last year.
Siskin.
And there was a passage in there, which, let me just read it to you, that said, in the period of which we speak, as you know, this was 1738 in Paris, there reigned in the cities a stench barely conceivable to us modern men and women. The streets stank of manure, the courtyards of urine, the stairwells stank of mouldering water, and on and on and on. This inventory of smells, and it's all there in Shakespeare as well. There's this use of language about, oh, my offences rank, use of smell words. And it's obviously such an important part of our entire being that it must have been very satisfying to you to actually be working on something that was had such human and personal importance.
Yes, but we were aware of that before our observations. As I said earlier, indeed, all of the senses impact in somewhat different ways, one might argue, on our internal state and our emotive state. Indeed, we associate smells with different things. For me, the smell of the city is more attractive than the smell of the country. It's my world. And this brings up a sort of a very interesting notion that perhaps was supported by Proust, and that is that odor is really an evocative sense, that odors can bring forth vast memories. So, of course, in Proust, the smell of a Madeleine in Combray brought forth 7 volumes of remembrances of things past. Now, thankfully, odors don't elicit that voluminous memory in all of us. But you might ask yourself, why is it that odor is for some individuals so evocative of memories. And I've tried to think about this, and one reason I believe is that it is impossible for you to describe an odor to anyone else such that they will know what you're talking about. There is no language to describe an odor, as there is a language to describe a visual scene. In fact, there are pictures. There is music, which is written. But there is no language for odors. There is no communicable description of an odor.
So you might say that's a bit strawberry-like or a bit vanilla-like, but that's actually a taste.
But that, of course, doesn't help you. I mean, and so what you need, so what you do is, because you can't describe it in any kind of language, you associate it. And so the scent of a woman, which is indescribable, conjures forth for you memorable moments.
In your autobiographical essay for the Nobel Prize Foundation, the first line is, "New York City is my world." You obviously have a wonderful feel for the city. You loved growing up there. Could you give me some sense of what that was like, what your family is like, how you got from there to here?
I came from a rather modest family of Eastern European immigrant parents, who my father was a tailor. And there was rather little my parents were not educated people. They were intelligent people and extremely warm. But I was the first and among the few people in my family to have completed high school or to go to college. In college, it was unclear which direction I would turn. I was a chemistry major and an English major. And like many young people in the 60s, should I go this way or should I go that way? And the direction I went was determined by the rather unfortunate Vietnam War. And so I was drafted. And I very quickly applied to medical school in the hope of a deferment. And so I went to medical school. And I told this story yesterday of finding myself in a place where I was not competent, and I was asked by the dean to never practice medicine on live patients, and I did an internship in pathology and was asked by the chairman never to practice medicine on dead patients. And so there was really rather little left for me but to go into science. And science in the early 70s was really followed the enormous initial discoveries in molecular biology. And so I turned to molecular biology.
When you're writing about New York, it's wonderful, elegiac, sort of evocative writing. Growing up there, doing jobs, working as a waiter in Greenwich Village. You're obviously a tall man. You talk about having played basketball. You're on the courts a lot. People sometimes think that scientists of your stature, caliber, must have had a very bookish upbringing. But that's not the case, is it? You did the sorts of things that other people do as well.
I certainly did the things that other people do, and it really was a learning experience for me to live in this world. New York is a marvelous city. It's a city that is so suffused with the different cultures of its immigrant population that provides the city with a diversity that leads to enormous excitement. I found the culture and background of this world in New York City to be so overpoweringly influential on my world. But of course, I did all these things, but you must remember that I wasn't good at them. So I played basketball because I went to high school for, it was a high school for students that scored well on examinations. Stuyvesant. And I was the starting center for Stuyvesant just because the school was largely composed of the sons of Marxist immigrants, none of whom were terribly good basketball players. And there is this story, which I've recounted, where I came up in my junior year against a fellow named Lou Alcindor, who was playing for Powell Memorial, another high school in Manhattan. He was 7 feet tall, and I was the starting center against him. And he scored 54 points against me in a high school basketball game. And I recall when I first got the ball after he had scored 14 points, I faked to the right, and I faked to the left, and he looked at me and he said, "What you gonna do, Einstein?" And he turned out to be Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, arguably the greatest basketball player that ever lived, and I study olfaction. Who hath the greater degree of ecstasy?
You developed a great love in the early years for the arts, for opera as well. I'm reminded that the first deputy director of the Salk Institute here was a man called Jacob Bronowski, who was well known for doing a public television series called The Ascent of Man, and for bringing together the arts and the sciences, the two cultures. Is that something that's very important to you?
Important for what? It's important for me to experience the richness of the arts. The relationship of science and art is a talked-out arena. I mean, the reality is that each of the endeavors requires a creativity. But I think beyond that, the comparisons become difficult. I mean, after all, William Blake said, "That which is proven was once only imagined." And that's very true in science. There is an imaginative period, a creative period, which in the arts plays out in the creation of a work, whereas in science, beyond the creative moments, the rest is really requires a rigor and a dedication that I think is quite distinguishes the doing of science from the doing of art. There are other things that, of course, distinguish it, and that is, and this isn't necessarily bad, in science, were there no Jim Watson and no Francis Crick, we would know the structure of DNA. In the arts, were there no Rembrandt, were there no Picasso, we would not have the Demoiselles d'Avignon. And so there is a uniqueness to the contributions in art that isn't apparent in science. Yes, it may take a bit longer had the giants of science not existed, but this information would be here in much the same way that without Shakespeare, there is no Lear and will never be a Lear.
You mentioned Jim Watson and Francis Crick. I think there's a public perception that the way science is done, and the way to win a Nobel Prize is you go down to the pub, have a few beers, fiddle with a Tinker Toy model, have a Eureka experience, and bingo, you have the double helix. At the other end of the spectrum, of course, is the work of somebody like Roger Guillemin, another Nobel laureate here at the Salk Institute, whose work involved literally grinding up hundreds of thousands, perhaps even millions of sheep brains to get even a small amount of the brain hormone he required. Where on the spectrum does your work lie?
Well, the identification of the odorant receptors themselves required really a concerted effort for almost 5 years by a student, a postdoctoral fellow in the lab, Linda Buck. A lab in the modern world functions is I might have conversations with my students about what is an exciting arena and how one might approach its solution. And then the student goes off and, with constant conversations, does the work as it is written in the Bible, the work of the righteous is done by others. So Linda worked on this for 5 years, and the receptors were revealed. Now, the receptor genes themselves provided only a solution to the first question, that is, how do you recognize the information in the environment. But a little bit of looking at these receptors and the way in which they were expressed in the sensory cells in the nose also began to tell us how it is that the system was organized. It sort of fell forth from looking at the way the genes were expressed, that we began to get some insight into how the information in the periphery was actually being relayed to the brain in a form that would allow for discrimination. Now, we're not yet there, but the very beginnings of that model came very quickly upon the identification of the receptors. I'm rather eclectic and work on a number of things, and olfaction has held my interest more so than any of the other fields of molecular neuroscience I've engaged in.
Probably because of what you were saying earlier about the memory component, it occurs to me, of course, that Eric Kandel, another Nobel laureate who works on memory, is at Columbia at the moment. So your paths must cross quite a bit. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, Eric Kandel and I are extremely close. In fact, the whole neuroscience community at Columbia is unique in the affiliative nature of the group. I've not observed this anywhere else in the world, actually. It's a marvelous culture, and it's best or well illustrated, I think, by my association with Eric. Now, my early years, I was a molecular biologist without any insight into neurobiology at all. I participated in the revolution of recombinant DNA. I learned how to cut and paste and sequence DNA sequences and introduce these sequences into cells and organisms. And it was all a lot of fun. While Eric was at the same time quite unfamiliar with molecules and certainly not at all familiar with DNA or RNA, and he was working out in precise detail the functional anatomy of a neural circuit in a simple organism which had the capacity to learn. And it was in 1980 that I came together with Eric. We were actually at a faculty meeting. Faculty meetings tended at Columbia to be intensely boring. And I knew that Eric was interested in memory, and I said, Eric, we need to work on the molecular biology of memory. And we began to talk, and we actually worked together for a while. And Eric taught me neurobiology. Now, can you imagine a greater person to provide insight into neurobiology? And at the same time, I taught him molecular biology. One of my students worked together with Eric and I, Richard Scheller. Richard is a neurobiologist who now is the vice president of Genentech and in charge of research. It was a spectacular time when the two of us sat and talked and tried to understand one another. And of course, what could be more pleasurable than for me to learn that Eric won the Nobel Prize in 2000 for his studies on the molecular biology of memory. And then 4 years later, and of course I joined him in Stockholm. And then 4 years later, he joined me.
You've obviously had a very rewarding and fulfilling career. Could you imagine what you might have done if you hadn't been a scientist?
I could have been bored. One doesn't know those things. One, both in science and in life, one is opportunistic in some sense. One latches on to that which one loves and then pursues it with a vigor and an excitement and a rigor and a dedication that what would I do? Well, I'm much happier being a scientist than I would be as a professor of English, which is something that had entertained my mind because I prefer exploring rather than critically evaluating.
Is there anybody, historical, dead, alive, that you would have liked to have had a conversation with, ask some questions of?
Yeah, there are lots of people I would like to have conversation with. And I feel very fortunate. I'm exposed to extremely smart people, both in science and outside of science, with whom I do have conversations. I mean, I live in the world of the arts and writing, and it's just been a real pleasure. I mean, one would like to have the opportunity to talk to any interesting person. Be he a cook in a delicatessen, or a great writer in his loft overlooking the sea.
Well, I was thinking. I mean, suppose you were in a time warp and you could have gone to Gregor Mendel and said, "Do you know how many genes it takes for a sense of smell?"
You know, if I had my choice, I think I might choose Descartes.
Why?
Well, I think, you know, this whole issue of perception has been considered in over time since the very earliest of the Greek philosophers. I mean, Plato's cave scenario really questioned what I call this tension between image and object, between physical reality and the brain's perception of physical reality. It's something we in neuroscience think about and should think about quite a bit. But the reality is that history, philosophy, has a long history of thinking about perception while ignoring the brain. And now we're in a really unique situation where we can actually study these disciplines, which were formerly in the hands of philosophers and psychologists who considered the brain a black box. And now we can open that box and begin to look at it. So it's a very exciting time in neuroscience right now.
I noticed that in your banquet speech at the Nobel Awards, you gave a presentation and mentioned the conflict between intellect and political and religious authority and how those issues were intensifying. And you actually quoted Jacob Bronowski on those issues. Is this something that you think about on a regular basis?
Well, I think it's particularly important, the issue of academic freedom and intellectual freedom. And it's a freedom that I think has, in the current time in the United States, been compromised. And I do believe that we as scientists are being restricted in our efforts based upon what I believe is religious ideology. And the stem cell debate is one particularly clear example. I experienced the debate over recombinant DNA, which had perhaps a more measured period of controversy. But again, there are numerous instances in science when apocalypse was predicted and nothing happened. I mean, there's little question that science comes without value. That is, a piece of science has the potential to be enormously valuable and has the potential for harm. But we are a long way down the road in the generation of science, and science has and inexorably will affect our lives, and it's the scientist's obligation, as it is the public's obligation, to recognize this and see to it that science, although not restricted in its endeavor, be used for the benefit of man. And in fact, Bronowski thought about this quite more eloquently than I can.
Each year, the literary agent John Brockman asks a group of people a question. And in 2007, the question was, what are you optimistic about? Could I ask you the same question? What are you optimistic about?
Well, I think I've already intuited or intimated my optimism about the movement of neuroscience. I mean, neuroscience is really gaining a momentum. The integration of disciplines, that is, bringing cognitive psychology together with molecular biology, electrophysiology, the introduction of extremely powerful technologies that I just observed downstairs in Terry's lab, really provide me with an excitement that we can understand something. Now, we're not going to understand how it is that an odor evokes the memory of events in one's life in my lifetime. But we are going to begin to be able to make substantive contributions to our understanding of perception, memory, and ultimately cognition. And we're hopefully going to be able to understand how it is that these processes, which after all can only involve neurons, since that's all there is in your brain, how it is that these processes are transformed in disease states. And this is it's going to be an even more exciting time. And if I can continue to do this and still go to the opera, I'll be a happy man.
Richard Axel, thank you.